Does the giddiness quotient go up this time of year here? It does at George Fox. I get giddy. Maybe it's just that I get giddy, and so I think the whole world gets giddy. And I think it's because it's the end of the semester. Certainly this time of year, I'm still a little bit giddy when it comes to Christmas, too, although the depth of it, and I appreciate your president's prayer about, and the songs we sing, "Oh, Come, O Come, Emmanuel," what a beautiful longing that we have that gets realized when God becomes human and walks among us. But I think anyway, if it's a giddy time of year, it's a great time to talk about sex, because we're already giddy, we're already wanting to laugh. So I thought what really good timing it was for these chapels to come here. I understand this week that you've heard about lust and love and the difference between them, and that vomit was mentioned, and I thought that was really a clever way to talk about lust versus love. And I don't know how many of you participated in last night's conversations. I was part of the women's conversation with two really great women that you have on campus that were being very vulnerable and open. You know, I can come and be vulnerable and open and you'll never see me again, so there's not really much risk with that. You have some great women, and I thought you men should know that both of those women said, "Asbury has terrific men." And one of them, who had been at other campuses, said, "I've been other places. Asbury has really terrific men." So you men are very well thought of by some of the women who are observing you. I wasn't even talking about students. I wanted to ask a couple, and I did ask a couple people, what do students think about the series where you focus on sexual purity and relationships? And I got a couple interesting answers. But most of them expected, one of them a little bit less expected, which maybe ties in well to some of the things I'll say today. One is that, well, we're thinking about it anyway. So it just gives some legitimacy to us being able to talk about what we're thinking about sex, some of our frustrations, some of our anxieties around it. It allows us space to talk about it. I would have expected that answer. I expected a little bit. One person said, "I think people are kind of annoyed with it, especially people who are thinking, I'm so far away from even imagining that I might have to think about oral sex or sex. All I want to know is why I'm so unlovable that nobody's ever asked me out on a date." I thought, oh yeah, that was well said. And then I also heard, I'm putting my own words to this one, because Asbury is a community of faith. It's an academic community, but it's also a kind of community of faith that wants to help you negotiate your longings, your relationship longings, and that this is a good place to do it. You're with peers who are sharing, for the most part, the same values, and this is a good place to do it. So they want to come alongside you, knowing it's not an easy conversation, and have some conversation starters. So what I want to do, I'm going to come as a sociologist who is a deep person of faith, and do a little bit of a cultural critique. How did we get where we are, and what is the subcontext for you all as people of faith in trying to negotiate this? What can we learn from our culture? And then I want to leave you with some four conversation starters, talking points that I hope this conversation goes well beyond this week and well into next semester for you. So some of your context. On the one hand, if you grow up in a faith community, you grow up being told, don't do it. You may not be sure exactly, and you really want to find a little bit what all it involves, but don't do it is what you grow up with. And yet you also grow up in a very voyeuristic culture where sex is around you all the time, and it appears as though everybody's doing it, again, it being defined rather broadly. And if you weren't at Asbury, that the conversation probably wouldn't even be had, because the assumption would be that everybody was involved in sex in some way. You're encouraged to think about it through ads. You're encouraged to think about your self-image, whether or not you're attractive and lovable. Mostly the message is love is about sex, or maybe love is about pleasure. Sex in the City, a TV series, and then later movies now, really made public and common the possibility that women want it just for pleasure too. And so we have conversations of what is it like then if you're choosing to deny yourself from something that the rest of the world is saying you ought to be engaged in. Two simple facts as we begin. One is that you are sexual, even if you're not sexually active. I asked my students in my sexuality class what it means for them to be sexual, and I have a number of them that every year that respond with something like, I don't really have any idea what it means to be sexual because I'm not sexually active. You are sexual even if you're not having sex. So as Asbury, as I've said, is a faith community, as much as it's an academic one, your administration and your student life staff, and a good few of you know that as a community of sexual beings, you all need to have some good conversation about what it does mean to be sexual, even if not sexually active. What do you do with your longings as you embrace Christian values that, for the most part, you share? You're sexual, even though you're not having sex. And you're unsure how to be appropriately sexual. You're not alone in that. What is appropriate? How can I express it? A second fact is that there's a fair bit of conflict about being sexual. On this campus, it would be very unusual if I was saying that and it wouldn't be true here. Some of you are having sex, and you may or may not feel conflicted about that, but I imagine in this context, if you're having sex here, you probably do feel conflicted about that. A lot of you are not having sex, and you may feel conflicted about that too. A few of you are attracted to people of your own sex and likely feeling some deep conflict about that. What does this conversation mean for you? What does healing potentially mean for you? If you all want to be a community that supports and stands with and encourages each other in whatever place that you're in, you need to be a community that can acknowledge that you're coming from different places, that you have different feelings about sex and different struggles and different histories. And you want to, and I think you do, create safe places where those differences can be talked about. So that's why one of the reasons I think Asbury talks about, has this conversation every year, to create safe places where you can become sojourners on this kind of complicated, conflictual journey that is where you are right now, as people of faith living in a culture that has pretty different values about sex. What does it mean to be sexual beings who, for the most part, aren't having sex? I want to start by trying to broaden the definition of what it means to be sexual. Can we embrace a sexuality that has less to do simply with intercourse or sexual behaviors that lead to sex, and more to do with how you relate to people, not just of the other sex, but also of your own sex? Can we think more redemptively about beauty, and I'll talk about that some today, and being drawn to the human body as being a beautiful and a good thing rather than something to feel shame about? Can we think differently and better about touch, our longings for touch, and better understand our fears surrounding touch? We'll wrap around each of these. But I want to back up for just a brief moment and talk about lessons that we learn about how we should feel about sex and sexuality. We grow up learning what we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to behave to get the goods of society that they offer, and these in sociology we'll call them scripts, that are built on our longings and our desires and our fears and our needs. And the current script that's pretty pervasive in our culture and in most Western cultures is that people should meet their sexual relationship or their sexual needs through non-committed or slightly committed or committed relationships. But you have sexual needs, you ought to meet them. You ought to have sex. That's the script that's out there. Be responsible, have safe sex. It's really kind of repressive and unhealthy to abstain. So we grow up with that out there. But inside the faith communities, the different script, and this is one that you hope is true if you're waiting for sex until you get married, is that marriage is going to assuage the loneliness of your heart. It will give you the emotional and the physical companionship you long for. You hope that's true, and I'll talk about why I think that's also a bit of a troubling message. Mark and I have done research now on four Christian, my husband Mark, who's a psychologist. People say our children were hopeless to grow up with a sociologist and a psychologist, and I think they turned out okay, but we've done research on four Christian campuses, and we've asked students about their hopes and fears about relationships and marriage, and what we find amazing is that you're all saying the same thing. We've never had a group of students who said something that was very much different. The number one hope that men and women both express is that they want to be known and to be loved. And, you know, we thought women might express some of these more romantic, gushy things more than men, but we're finding men want the same things. They want to grow old with someone, and they express that to the same extent that women do. There's a strong desire for a sense of belonging. The number one fear, which is true at every campus we've been at, is that you fear rushing into marriage or settling. And I think that might be unique to Christian campuses. I mean, you're here, and even though we try to talk down that ring by spring thing, there's this thought, if I don't find someone here, I'm not going to ever find anybody. Where else will I ever have such a pool of opportunity? And so you fear that you might settle. You might rush into something out of desperation. And then that looks a little bit different for men and women. For men, their number one fear when we pull it out is that they're not going to live up to expectations. They're not going to live up to her expectations. We had one student at a school say, I'm scared to death of the women's expectations at this school. Keeps me from dating them. I'm scared of them. As I know I won't meet up to their expectations. And they have that fear as it comes when they think about relationships. The number one fear for women, the way they express it, is being known and then not loved. You know, he'll marry me, we'll live together, and then I'll kind of, he won't love me anymore. I won't be as attractive to him anymore. I won't be the person he thought I was. Both is this fear of being ultimately a disappointment. Very similar. So the Christian script feels incomplete because it is. We haven't adapted it well to your time and place in our American culture. You're supposed to abstain from sex until you get married. The average age of marriage now is about 27. But you guys have been awakened to sexual desire since you were 12 or 13. That's a long time of abstaining. We tell you just don't do it. But we have to start building something more redemptive about what does it mean to be sexual beings now? What if I never get married? What does it mean to be sexual beings in my singleness? It's hard to have confidence in our Christian values about sex and relationships unless we disassemble what we learn outside our faith and reassemble something that we can bring back into our faith. So what do women learn about what it takes for them to be lovable? Well, you're socialized that your worth is determined by how beautiful and sexy you are. And this actually is historically true. You go back to the story of Esther, and that was how Esther gets chosen as well. The winners get the good men, though if you're in Hollywood, you keep losing those good men. You lose them to beautiful younger women, and that's everybody's fear, is that, I want at least an adequate man, but I have to be really beautiful if I'm going to hope to get that. Most women win if they're beautiful. I got online and started looking at some of the, successful women. Number two top grossing actresses right now are Reese Witherspoon. I don't know if this surprises you, and Cameron Diaz. They're tied for number two. The number one top grossing actress is Sandra Bullock. Well, never mind. I'm really glad that Meryl Streep is at least acknowledged as the best actress. I think she's phenomenal. Oprah Winfrey is an interesting kind of exception to this. She's very wealthy, very successful. She's beautiful, but not stereotypically so. Most often, the beauty that is given for women to achieve is white, it's thin, it's large-breasted, it's fit, it's really white teeth, it's good hair. And that's what it takes. And so often, we as women become obsessed about what we look like because we think our lovability depends on it. Women are competing with each other for the good man. I think that's especially true. I don't know what your ratio is at Asbury. Probably not 50-50, right? We struggle with that at our Christian schools. So you're especially feeling like you might be competing here. And since other women become our competitors, we can be brutal with each other. You, and I don't mean you, I'll say we here. We can judge and criticize each other. Our fears begin to separate us. Many women, by the fourth grade, become obsessed by what they look like. It's a normative obsession, it's been called, which is similar perhaps to male obsessions with success and strength and independence. So we have this Christian addition to all that says be beautiful, but be virginal. Maybe flirt a little bit, but certainly don't be slutty. You might have to get your man by getting him to notice you by, flipping your hair and doing all kinds of movements with your body, but be virginal. Be followers rather than leaders. And sadly, beauty is defined very narrowly. It's hard to blend the cultural values and the Christian ones. And it's no wonder that she fears losing her husband when she thinks that that's what attracted him to her. And if that goes, if she gets too much hair in the wrong places or grows flabby, then she won't be acceptable anymore. Have you ever considered how our economy needs us to be insecure so we keep buying stuff to make us better? It's really interesting. our economy actually depends on us being unsatisfied, thinking that we're ugly and that we need this or that to make us more acceptable. Men, you receive messages that your worth and masculinity are determined by things like strength and toughness, wealth, independence. Interesting look at heroes of today, Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie that tells his story. It's a rather fascinating one. He's the youngest self-made billionaire at 23. He was a self-made billionaire. How many of you are on Facebook? You all helped him out there. He's now 28. He's worth nearly $7 billion. Or born the same year as Zuckerman, LeBron James, now with the Miami Heat, who has a very interesting way of promoting himself, I suppose, and an image, a particular image. Or Will Smith, who's the top grossing male actor. Or Justin Bieber. He's one of the people that Barbara Walters has identified, along with LeBron James, as one of the most interesting people in 2010. These become your comparison point as men. Am I sexy? Am I smart? Am I successful? And I can be geeky as long as I'm really wealthy, which is the Mark Zuckerman. Am I creative? Will I amount to much? And in the Christian subculture, sexually controlled, because you're supposed to be sexual and you're supposed to have control, it gets turned on its head in a way that you're not supposed to succumb to any sexual temptation. You're supposed to be so in control of your sexuality that masturbation, pornography, lust wouldn't be problems for you. That's what you think she's looking for, and that also makes you a little bit insecure. To be lovable, men believe, is to be tough. To be at least promising, if you're not wealthy now, at least promising that you might be able to afford a family. And be pure, strong Christian men. Maybe a cross between Justin Bieber and LeBron James and Donald Miller. It's no wonder that you fear you won't live up to expectations. As I said, some version of this has plagued humanity through the ages for both men and women. It just has its particulars in our culture, and it gets displayed in our ads and our movies, and it comes into our souls, and it affects the way that we feel about ourselves. They feed into our fears of inadequacy, and they raise the questions about what are we supposed to do with our sexuality, which begins to feel a lot more like a burden than a blessing. You're sexual beings. You are alive with longings and desires, and those are good and holy longings. They make the world a hope-filled place. How then shall you live? I want to read a couple verses from a very familiar passage as I move into these four starting talking points. This is from Romans 11, the last bit of Romans 11, and then the first couple verses in Romans 12. 11, 33, and 36 is part of the doxology that precedes Romans 12. Oh, how the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good and pleasing and perfect will. And down to verse 9, love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, and faithful in prayer. It's a beautiful picture of a community of believers that are loving each other with mutual affection and showing honor to each other and rejoicing in hope and patient in suffering. And that could be a picture of what it's like for you as sexual beings walking this rather challenging at times journey. How do we let this kind of love be transformative to our sexual lives as men and women? Four conversation points that I hope will stimulate enough that you'll continue to have them. The first one is to think about our sexuality being expressed not through sex, but intimate friendships. That's where you are right now. So what would it look like if they could be expressed more fully in intimate friendships? Frodo Baggins, I love this character out of the Fellowship of the Rings. And the way that J.R.R. Tolkien brings, maybe it's Sam Ganji that's the hero here, but these two, if you've either read, I think the movie does a good job with this too, but if you've read the books as well, Tolkien depicts fortitude and strength and friendship and loyalty of this whole fellowship of nine that take this hard, arduous, very dangerous journey together, but then particularly the relationship between Frodo and Sam. Frodo could not have completed that mission without Sam. They loved each other. It was really evident that they had a non-sexual, intimate, fantastic kind of love for each other. They held each other. There are points when Sam is literally carrying Frodo. There's a lot in art and literature and music that reflects God's truths, and if we look for them, we'll find them. We don't just see what's distorted, but we can see what's beautiful. I think this is one picture of it. We might get more of a knowledge of what this looked like if we had more details of David and Jonathan's relationship in the Old Testament. There's a strong theme of Scripture that shows us loving each other, focusing more on that than being lovable. How do I love another? I've just been rewatching the Harry Potter movies. I read those for a few years ago. So in the last 10 days, I've gorged myself on all of them up until the one that's in the theaters right now. And there's also that shows up, I don't know how you feel about Harry Potter movies. I know they're somewhat controversial. But again, there's Harry is at times thinking, I've got to do this by myself. And his friends are saying, you're crazy. You can't do this by yourself. It requires all of these journeys. We're so independent, but they require a community of friends and a depth of relationship. You are created, we are created with a will to relate that's very strong in our particular species. It gets told in all of our great epic tales. Our sexuality, our male and female creatureliness, our desire for intimacy represents a holy longing reflected in God's putting in our hearts this will to relate. Sometimes it's very distorted and broken, but we have it. The will to relate is a good will. The desires that you have are good desires. We're relational creatures, and part of what we long for is just to be validated and loved, to have people play with us that are our own sex, not just the other sex, but our own sex. We want burden-bearing friendships. We want to be affirmed as males by males and as females by females. There's been so much focus in the last part of the 20th century on genital sexual relationships that we lose sight of. We don't practice very well. We don't pursue same-sex intimate friendships. Maybe that's not as much in college. But here, too, it can be a place of great loneliness where you feel surrounded by people. You should have great friends, and yet you feel yourself somewhat lonely. Relationships are life-giving. We all know that. They give us strength to carry on and to live well. They give us counterpoints where we can talk about questions that we have about our sexual relationships. But they themselves are part and parcel of our sexuality because they emerge out of our longing for relationship too, even if there's no sex involved in them. Now, I hope that a lot of you say, you're wrong about that. I have really good same-sex friendships. And I believe some of you can say that. I hope a lot of you can say that. But I also think that most of you think everyone else can say that, and you might be the only one who can't. We need to be a culture that really embraces our same-sex intimacy without the fear that it's gay. I think that gets in the way so much that we fear if we say I love you to a friend that we may be going down a road that we get nervous about. We're intended for community. Can you challenge messages that prey on your fears of inadequacy and put you in competition with each other? Can you turn the conversation from what it takes to be lovable to how can you love others well? How can you embrace them? A second talking point is our sexuality allows us to respond to beauty, to feel alive and awake. Wow, you might think as a beautiful woman or man walks by lifting you out of your end of the semester stupor. All of us, whether or not we're married or single or in a relationship, can thank God that we are inclined and drawn toward beauty, to respond to people that we find beautiful, even those that we're not in a relationship with. I think we feel so much angst and guilt about that. I'm in a relationship and I just found someone else attractive. What does that mean? I must be unfaithful. It means you are drawn to beauty and God created you to be drawn to beauty. To deny that is to deny a part of your sexuality that you can embrace wholeheartedly. It's complicated because our culture is incredibly pornographic. And so we have used beauty to make money. And we do it with ads indirectly. We do it with pornography directly. We took a wonderful part of our sexuality that we respond to beauty and made it a consumable product. And so all of this gets a bit more complicated. The ease with which we can be drawn into pornography shows how effectively we are, in fact, drawn toward beauty. Part of the challenge is to see through this pornographic culture that objectifies what's beautiful and also defines it really narrowly and only in sexual terms, to reject that to be beautiful is to have implants, your teeth whitened, extreme makeover made, plastic surgery normative for the middle class. I think that's such a sadness that beauty, which is so much deeper and richer than that, gets created to be so shallowly thought about. How can you respond to beauty? Acknowledge it when you see it as a simple appreciative way of noting a whole person and the beauty of a whole person. It's all around you. It's wholesome. You don't have to objectify others when you see it. It doesn't have to be pornographic. Mark had a group of students. He teaches grad students. I teach undergrad. They were over this fall, and I met a particularly beautiful woman. And after the event, I told Mark, Sarah is a beautiful woman. In doing so, I extended grace to the student instead of judging her and saying, wow, that Sarah really is trying to get attention. I also extend it to Mark, who is free to not feel guilty for probably noticing that she was beautiful and can engage and say, yeah, she is a beautiful woman. I allow myself to enjoy that beauty without feeling like I'm losing some competition because I'm not 20-something anymore. But also we need to broaden our images of what's beautiful. God created us to respond to physical beauty that's found in goodness and in health. I see beauty in a pose, in the way that somebody walks or bends or smiles or turns their head. We can be blessed by each other's beauty if we allow ourselves to open up and broaden that what we're seeing is a whole person who is beautiful. We need to redeem that. It's amazing how pornographic beauty has come to define the way we see it. When you find yourself responding in confusing ways to beauty, you can thank God for making you a sexual being that responds to beauty, for this reminder that you are sexually alive and well. You can ask God to channel those desires toward good beauty, to expand your vision of what is beautiful, to help you see and affirm beauty in places that you may tend to overlook. A third talking point is about touch. Frodo and Sam touch each other a lot in this movie. I see that on college campuses too. Some people get nervous about how much hugging happens. I actually think it's a good thing. I suppose there could be bad elements to a lot of hugging, but I tend to err on the side of really thinking it's a good thing. What's the role of touch for single and sexual beings? There's a lot of good questions here. There's questions for those of you in relationships, and we talked about this some last night. I imagine you did with the men, the women too. We need good conversation about the purpose of touch in relationships at various levels. The serial exclusive relationships that we have now is kind of new in our history, so we didn't have to figure out what touch happened as a precursor to marriage. It's confusing, and there's multiple Christian perspectives on it. I won't give one now. I want to move through several other talking points. But if you are in relationship, you need to have some good intentional conversation about the purpose of touch and separating out that sense of legitimacy that you have now that you're in a committed relationship, that all the doors are open to you, from also the goodness of restraint and what that means to think intentionally about touch that is affirming and touch that ends up making you feel kind of icky and become the dominant part of your relationship. Those not in dating relationships, humans long to be touched throughout life, whether or not they're in a relationship. We don't need to be sexually stimulated to be healthy, but we do need to be touched. How can we enjoy the simple touch of friendship without having to figure out what it all means? Maybe even today you brushed against somebody in chapel and there's this kind of sexual stimulating. Even a touch can be that. I mean, how can we just ramp down the angst we have about touch and also try to make not, you know, it's not also sexual, but our culture has largely made, we're touch phobic because we've made it all sexual. Coaches can't touch players, teachers can't touch students, childcare workers have to be very careful how they touch children. largely because we see sexist sexual. Can we broaden that up and recognize that touch is a human need we all have? Can we give ourselves permission to learn from those who come from families where touch was much more comfortable? Some people didn't really do much touch in their families. Can we have conversations about touch, about the very important aspects of males touching males, but males and females touching each other, and females seem to be more comfortable yet touching each other? You go to other cultures and you'll see men walking down the street holding hands, and they're not gay, they're just friends. We can't hardly imagine what that would look like here. Much conversation needs to be had around that. Jesus's ministry was certainly defined by touch. He healed through touch. The foot washing, blessings were all using touch. And a fourth talking point is about being single yet sexual means embracing what sexuality means for you now. Marriage is not the end-all, final fulfillment. Genesis really speaks the first few chapters beautifully about the unique relationship between a man and a woman. In intimate sexual relationships, we hope for our fundamental longings to be met. But it troubles me when I hear speakers talk to you all and say, wait until marriage because then sex is going to be fireworks fantastic. And if you have it before then, it's really not very good. The reality is people who have sex before they get married can still talk about it being pretty good. And some people never get married at all. And some people get married and sex is still a struggle for them. There's four problems with putting all your hope in marriage. First, it raises unrealistic expectations that marriage will satisfy all your needs. It was never intended to do that. Our Western romantic notions bolstered that up. Certainly, we are blessed, and Genesis talks about that well, so does Scripture, when we have a marriage relationship, somebody to partner with through life, but it wasn't intended to meet all of our needs. Second, it suggests there's no real way to satisfy sexuality needs apart from marriage. Sex, no, but there's so many opportunities available to you when you're single that are not available to you when you're married. There are depths that you can go to with your other relationships. There are adventures and opportunities and risks you can take that you can't take once you get married. We talked about some of that last night as well. Third, it doesn't offer any legitimate place for a choice to remain single. It's always the loser option. We've got to change the way we think about that. And fourth, there's no hope for people with same-sex attraction. I am stuck. If I'm same-sex attracted, I can't participate in genital sex. I'm estranged from my own. I'm not attracted to the other. I'm doomed to loneliness. So another challenge for us is to explore our views of marriage in light of Paul's teaching on singleness. And Jesus's example is one who lived very fully, and Jesus was a sexual being, though he didn't have sexual intercourse. Marriage is not the end all for sexual fulfillment. There is room now for you to find fulfillment, not sex, but through friendship and through touch and through beauty and embracing those aspects of who you are. Living with Christian convictions regarding being single does include an element of self-control, but it also includes being able to embrace what it means that you are sexual people who are drawn to beauty and drawn to touch. What does it look like for you to be sexual but not sexually active? Embrace sexuality as good, as a longing to be known and to be loved, to be accepted, to be touched, to be affected. Can being sexual include fostering intimate, passionate friendships? I hope so. Can you tell your friends you love them? Can being sexual mean you allow yourself to respond to beauty rather than chastise that or deny it, to be blessed by how it awakens you and enlivens you? Can embracing sexuality include acknowledging that you have a desire to be touched and to touch and having conversations with good friends about touch? Can you celebrate what you have now in your singleness, the rich relational opportunities you have for deep, deep lives with multiple others because you are not deeply obligated to one other? Sexuality is a holy longing. Wanting sex, wanting love, wanting belonging, those are all good desires. They're God-given desires. Marriage isn't the only fulfillment of what we long for. I highly recommend it. I've been married for 31 years, and I recommend it, but it won't happen for everybody, and it won't always be the ultimate fulfillment you seek. Only God will, at the end of the day, be the ultimate fulfillment that we seek for. Outside of marriage, we can still find sexuality a blessing and not a burden, one that draws us toward others, one where we can be touched and embraced, hopefully literally, known and loved as we know and love others. So I hope you'll go from here, from this week, and carry on conversations. They're deeply, deeply important and personal to you now. Let me close this in prayer and send you on your way. Father, thank you that you did create us as a species that is sexual and longs to be in relationship with others. And may we come to you often with our longings and also seek and find ways to go to each other with our longings and to be partners with each other. Bless these students as they go into their last week of class and finals, and may we carry Advent with us in these next days and the beautiful, hopeful reminder of what it was that you, God, became human and lived and dwelt among us. In your name we pray. Amen.